Hello, this is Sheila Bender. Welcome to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today we have guest Dennis Must with us, speaking to us from Massachusetts. Welcome, Dennis.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you.
I'm very much looking forward to speaking about your writing life and the work that you have out there. I'm going to read your bio right now. Dennis was born and raised in Newcastle, Pennsylvania, and he graduated in 1956 from Washington and Jefferson College in Washington, Pennsylvania, with a major in philosophy. Following 2 years at Princeton Theological Seminary, he decided against entering the clergy to attend the Playwrights Workshop at the University of Iowa, Iowa City. Thereafter, he taught at various locations in Pittsburgh and then in New York City while writing, directing, and co-producing his own plays with an artist friend and collaborator, John Hawkins. In the late 60s and early 70s, he wrote a lot of experimental work in non-commercial theater. Today, he is the author of short stories, plays, and now two new novels, The World's Smallest Bible and Hush, Now Don't Explain. Dennis, you've had a long career, and I'm very interested to hear about what happened between the playwriting and the teaching and the short stories and the novels. So let's start with the fact that you decided not to enter the clergy. Was that a difficult decision?
It was certainly came by surprise. I was only months away from really being ordained, and then there was a crisis of faith that occurred at the seminary. And once I began questioning certain tenets of what I believed in, and they all began to collapse. And at that point, I knew that I could not continue. And I had been writing at that time. I'd been writing a play, and I decided, well, what am I going to do? And so I matriculated at the playwriting workshop at Iowa, and I was there 1 year, and then returned with my family to Pittsburgh and began selling computers and typewriters, et cetera, and hoping that I would be ultimately able to go to New York and to write plays.
Why was playwriting the genre of choice for you at that time?
When I was at Princeton, the seminary, which is not a part of the university, but in that they're separate, they don't, the different boards of directors, et cetera, but they share classes, and a lot of students who decide to enter the ministry from Princeton go there at the seminary. So they are certainly very related. But there is a famous theater on the Princeton site called MacArthur Theater. I spent a lot of my time watching rehearsals during the 2 summers that I was there. And there was just something about theater that I loved and caught my imagination. I suspect it also had something to do when I was growing up. My father ran a variety show of singers and dancers and some people who would be comedians and would travel around to the various veterans hospitals to perform for the wounded soldiers.
So you kind of grew up with theater around you.
Yes, and also the fact that one of my goals, as you can see if you've read the book, spent a good portion of his life in various traveling carnivals and circuses playing different roles there. And so that was part of the attraction, that whole, whatever that is, that dramaturgy, as it were.
Right. Well, did you find at that time, was playwriting for you helpful in helping you consider and deal with the Dark Knight?
That's an interesting question. I don't know how to answer that, because once I left seminary, it was sort of like a real transformation that occurred. It was sort of, I began to wonder how I ever got there. And I think this is sort of what writing is about anyway. It was that, at least it is for me, as I love the quote by Anais Nin, who says, "We write to taste life twice." And that resonates a lot with me, because I write to often revisit these periods of my life, to relive them in some sense, but also to understand them better.
So you moved from writing plays to writing short stories.
I had several plays that were performed. I was both producing and writing them, and it was during the period of late 60s and early 70s where there was a lot of experimental theater occurring off Broadway. That was a very freaking period of time for me. But what occurred was when the last play was over, I had a new wife, and children were certainly going to come, and I had felt that I had indulged isn't the correct word, but perhaps somebody might use it, that it was time for me to move on and begin to earn some money and let my wife go on and get her doctorate, and that's sort of what happened. And so I didn't look back from that period. And I ultimately started with another person a corporate real estate business in Boston, which was very successful. Even though I missed writing a lot, I felt that I had my day, as it were. But then in early 1990s, 91, certainly here in the Northeast, the bottom went out of the economy. The banks were failing, and our business, which had, you know, over 30-some people employed, we were out in about 6 months, and with several offices. And to me, it was... Fortunately for me, it was a godsend, and I was able to go back to writing. But because I was in Boston, and I no longer had actors who were accessible to me, and or a theater, so I began to write short stories, and that's how that occurred.
Did you find that writing short stories was in any way similar to you, to playwriting, or was it a new learning curve?
Yes, it was similar in that. Then I made my own characters and saw them come to life on paper. The thing people have asked me, do I miss playwriting? The answer is, although it's too late in my life now, about to turn my 80th birthday, what I missed about theater was the collaborative aspect about it, that there just wasn't one creator, mm-hmm. that there were many of us. I'd write a play, the script would be there, and then the actors and I would sit down over a six-month period and rehearse it and think about it and mold it and transform it to each of their own identities to a certain extent. So when it was finally on, it was truly a collaborative experience, and we all shared in that joy, as it were, that joy of creation. And that's the part that I do miss.
But you've gone on from writing many, many short stories to writing novels now.
Right.
So what happened in that transition?
What happened was that I got lucky. I've been writing novels all along. The way I work is that virtually every day of the week, certainly every work day, Monday through Friday, and sometimes on the weekend, I come up to my study and I sit here and hope to produce something, and some days it's a sentence, and some days it's several pages. The way I work is that I'm always working on a much longer piece, and then I intersperse that with short stories.
I see.
And for years I've had a service that gives me sort of a time that I have to work towards, a deadline, as it were, because every 2 months they... asked me for a new short story. I have to give them one, or I have to beg off and say I can't have it. I'm only allowed to do that twice a year.
I see.
Or I give them, or one of the stories that hasn't been accepted, we send that out again.
Can you tell us the name of that service?
Yes, it's called Writer's Relief, and they're out of Hackensack, and all one has to do is write writersrelief.com, and that'll come up.
Okay, well, thank you. So it works for you to have them hounding you for work. But in between, you've either been writing the short stories in between the novels or writing the novels in between the short stories. And the result is two novels, and one of which I think you're prepared to read from a little bit on the air now.
Yes.
So that one is The World's Smallest Bible, and I'd love to hear the excerpts that you're going to read.
I'm going to read a short section, and I think the listeners will get from the context, from what I read, this person I'm speaking about. I perhaps may speak more directly about him after, if you, Sheila, feel it's necessary.
Okay.
I'm reading now. He was an inspiration to me and, in essence, my real tutor. Not Mildred Sargent, math teacher who spoke of fixed sums, nor the doll stories I read in English class, or the countless exams I took over the years, parroting what I'd supposedly learned and that soon after blew away like dandelion seeds. But it was our neighbor's owl light hammering against steel housing, watching the gas blue spark of Stanley's welding torch light our window panes that fired my imagination. Like him, I longed to create our very own perpetual motion machine, one that Jeremiah and I could drive, the Maytag washer engine propelling us across all the continents and tracing each river veining the plaster above our bed. I fantasized transporting us out of the toxic fog of waste fires that burn nonstop in the quarry up our street, to escape our town's low ceilings, to cast off the ladders of achievement its fathers had roped to our backs, the parochial prescriptions of right and wrong lying on our bedside table. I wanted to escape all of that, to breathe, to sting, with Stanley Kuzak's hammer and anvil, the fire whooshing out of his acetylene torch. I wanted to cry, freedom, God Almighty, freedom from our forebears' constricted dreams of despair, misfortune, and sheer failure. We were still children, Popeye and me, and after the lights clicked off, we'd figure out a way to break free of our confinement. The prison that 1 and 1 equals 2, 10 divided by 2 equals 5, 20 subtract 7 equals 13, or C, spot chump. And then, of course, there was a pull-down map hanging above the blackboard in our classroom. On the illustrious 48, we had to memorize each state, its capital, agriculture products, famous citizens, especially past and present politicians, and flower, bird, or song. Employing the call and response technique, Winona Slocum tapped the oilcloth with her cue stick pointer while I dreamed of motoring across those flat, anemic green, yellow, and umber shapes with Popeye exploring for ourselves what grew in their bounteous fields and who populated their starlit metropolises. Schoolhouse learning felt as if the pedagogues had minced all that was authentic about life into cereal flake facts, and each academic day for 12 tedious years sprinkled these out of sallow boxes into porcelain bowls with no liquid to wash it down. Some classmates took to these facts and figures like mice to barncorn. But early on, I grasped that if this was what I had to digest to enjoy a full and prosperous life of necessity, I'd have to master dramaturgy. Like Stanley Kuzak, I'd satisfy my dreams when the sun gave way to darkness. Attending class became yet another noxious chore that bored me in its devout earnestness, a fact of which my mediocre grades gave ample evidence. Filching 6 or 7 of the best hours out of each juvenile's day until he or she became grown up, I deemed unconscionable.
Thank you, Dennis.
You're welcome.
I love that term, flake facts. And in the bowls with no liquid. It's such a wonderful combination of just acute observation of daily life and making the metaphor for how irrelevant academic learning can feel. Thank you. Did you have another excerpt to read?
I do. This is towards the end of the book, and the brothers who attempt to, they've separated, and they're now adults. Periodically, they communicate over very late night or early morning calls, and there's a kind of wistfulness that they each share. And the irony, of course, is they're missing the fires that they survived or were able to withstand of their youth. And so I'm reading the narrator's thoughts about that, and I'm called it sort of longing for the amniotic fluid of childhood. What I had thought about often, even years before Jeremiah broached the subject, was how I never felt so alive as when he and I slept alongside each other. When I became a so-called man and put away childish things, as the Bible would have it, the riveting drama evanesced, as if life became a series of catching handfuls of fog instead of fire, tasting mist instead of an imagined woman suitor, enduring long stretches of a monotonous hum instead of assuaging fears of what lay at the bottom of our cellar stairs. Putting on a suit and going to work each day did affect a kind of quiescence. The surprises awaiting around one around the corner, in the mirror, or outside the bedroom door in the hallway had been muzzled. Day in, day out. See Dick run, see Spot jump. Yes, it was very much like going to school again. Dead men walking. And the more I considered this, the more I thought about Stanley and his friends, how they shot the gorge, it seemed, in an effort to brutalize themselves to come alive again, as if they were missing large pieces of themselves, attempting to fly back into their bodies, which had abandoned them, or perhaps their souls, or perhaps, like Jeremiah and me, trying to call our youth back to us so we could feel alive once again.
Thank you. Jeremiah is Popeye, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
Stanley is a neighbor that our narrator, Ethan,
is the older brother.
Yeah. Thank you so much. This is such vivid writing, catching fog instead of fire. I love it. And I'd love to ask you this question. I had the feeling reading your novel that there was some autobiography in there, and I'm wondering if there was.
Yes, indeed there is. I was at a reading I read last night and close by here in Cambridge, and somebody asked me that question after the reading, that very question, and they said, could you put a percentage on what part is autobiographical and what part is fiction? And I can't do that. But what I can say is that those people are the subject of my book, are those people, for the most part, that I grew up with. But then At a certain point, improvisation, imagination takes over. So any one of these people who would read this from that time, including my sisters who are still alive, this book in some extent was a love song to my brother, who died at an early age for me. He died at about 47, 48. Unexpected death. But my sisters, when they have read my work before, and certainly they're now reading this, they will say to me, well, that's not how I remembered it. And I think that's very true. That is very true. I don't know whether that is a satisfactory answer to you.
Oh, it's a very satisfactory answer. Whether it's your imagination or the actual facts of your childhood, there's a vividness that just shines through that makes me think the author really lived there. And you said this is based on the place where you grew up.
Yes.
An interesting thing about this novel is that it has illustrations. And I'm wondering how you chose to include them, or if it was your choice to put illustrations in.
Yes, it was my choice, and it was a fortuitous one. Because I'm aware, as certainly any writer, and I suspect reader is, and that we are increasingly moving towards a more visual society. Mm-hmm. And that my sense is that words are themselves are on the decline in how we express ourselves creatively. And my sense was is that when I finished this book, I thought, oh, how wonderful it would be if I could have some illustrations of it. And yet it wasn't the kind of book that lent itself to normally the illustrators that one comes across are those that illustrate children's books, and I thought I needed to have somebody that had a bite, there was an edge to the illustrations. And I looked on the web, and I fortunately came across this young man, Russ Spitkovsky, who was a young Russian immigrant, and I had seen a book about the Holocaust. This woman author had relatives or some, I think it was relatives, and it was a very narrow book in terms of pages, but she had him illustrate some scenes relative to the Nazi regime. And as soon as I saw those, I thought, oh, I have to speak to this person. And I sent him the book and said, if this reads to you, do you feel you can respond to this, I'd love to have you work. And so that's what happened. And he did 20 illustrations all that are within this book, and which Charlie has put to great relief in terms of stunning quality on my website.
I just want to clarify for listeners that Charlie Fleischman, who is the sound engineer for our program here, has connected me with you as an author because he is familiar with your website, having designed it. And we're both very enthusiastic about these illustrations, as we are of your writing. And I'm wondering if you had any trouble when you submitted your manuscript for publication. Were the publishers okay with this?
What happened was is that I had decided when I saw, he sent me some early renderings of a few scenes, and once I saw them, I knew that the match was just absolutely perfect. And so I said, Russ, just simply go ahead and do these, and let's just do how many ever you want that you think captures how you. And again, it sort of goes back to the collaborative aspect of the theater that I had.
Absolutely.
When I worked in the theater, I think the same dynamic was working there. And so that's what happened. And I paid for them. I paid him for them, and without having any go-ahead from the publisher at all. But then once they were done, I thought my best chance for having a publisher say yes is for them to see the illustrations. And that's what happened. The publisher happened to be in Boston at another event, and I went and I said, Mark Cole, who's his name, I said, I want to show you these illustrations. And he said, oh, we have to do these, Dennis. And so that's how that happened.
Thank you for telling us. That's excellent. And they're quite stunning illustrations and bring a sense of the darkness that's in the book and the maturity, I think,
yes,
of the narrator's life voice,
yes,
to
yes,
light. And that makes me want to ask you a couple more questions. And one is about the place of religion in these characters' childhood and in this novel. I think that as a writer with a background growing up Catholic and growing up and studying to enter seminary, this has influenced your writing about these characters. And I'm just wondering if you might say something about that aspect of the book.
Well, first, a minor correction.
Okay.
My father was a dyed-in-the-wool Catholic, and my uncle was indeed a Monsignor and his brother, and my grandmother was a devout Catholic, and that whole side of the family was Catholic. My mother's side was Protestant, and my mother sort of was this very strong religious presence in our family. My father had sort of given up on it. My father was more of the earth than he was of the hereafter, as it were. And so it was, I suspect, not as I suspect, my sense is, as I look back upon it, that the influence that my mother had on both me and my brother, but certainly on me, is what caused this sort of an unbroken line of faith that moved me ultimately to the seminary. But then when I left it, I sort of abandoned my connection, religious connection with her. What happens here is that as the boys grow older, they understand that the adults that they're close with appear to be unable to withstand their mortality. And so their attempt to escape it, and my mother, for example, and many, many, many people in the community escaped it by believing in the hereafter, that life continues on, and that life involves, that real life involves suffering, and the reward occurs in the hereafter. Whereas my father, who was representative, or Ethan's father, representative, took refuge in earth's pleasures, women and alcohol and whatever else that they were able to salve their sense of a fatalism, the fatalism that I sensed early on that sort of had caught the town. And then there was Stanley Kuzak, the illiterate neighbor who wanted immortality, you know. And that's where he sought his escape. He said, in one line of the book, he says, one day he said, my name, you better mark it down. My name is going to be in that ANP, Atlantic and Pacific Encyclopedia. But then, of course, his perpetual motion machine that he worked over with all of his soul and life, of course, never ran. So that's sort of the summing up of that.
Right.
And So, yes, religion is part of it, but so is these other ways of trying to escape our mortal being, as
right.
it were.
Thank you. And before we close today, I would like to know a little bit about Hush Now, Don't Explain. Can you tell us about the premise of the book, the characters?
Yes. That is more of a traditional line-through novel, whereas The World's Smallest Bible is a... There are many short stories there that have combined into a novel form. Hush Now, Don't Explain is basically a young girl. It's the narrator is a young woman, and she is narrating her childhood and her growing into an adult. And the book opens where she is an orphan and has been in an orphan since she was a baby, and at the age of 10 is called down to the person who runs the orphanage's office, and she is handed a Bible. And on that Bible is an address, and she is told that this Bible was her mother's, and that was the only information that she's given. That is what the book is essentially about, is the search for her mother.
Well, Dennis, I'm really eager to read that one, too. And in our next interview, which I hope will occur during the year, I'd love to talk with you more about switching from writing about boys and something that's inspired by autobiography to writing with a girl protagonist. And for right now, though, I definitely want our listeners to know how they can find out more about you on your website, which is dennismust.com.
Yes.
And you spell must, M-U-S-T.
Yes.
And so Dennis, DennisMust.com. And I hope that our listeners will check out what's happening in your writing life. And can they read any excerpts on your website?
Oh, that's an interesting question. No, there aren't. Maybe at some point we will work on that.
Okay. Well, I'm sure that they can jump over to booksellers.
But what they can, though, Sheila, is that there is a whole bibliography of all my short stories there, and many of them have the URLs. You just click on them, and they'll take to the sites on the web about that they can read the short stories.
Perfect. Thank you so much, and I want to wish you a happy birthday coming up. And
thank you,
I look
kindly.
Forward to talking to you again.
It's been wonderful.
Thank you, Dennis.